the reason I came to this topic, I wanted to sort of talk in this sort of angle, is we usually associate effort with not very pleasant. And the whole intent of this talk is to talk about how effort leads to joy. How they're very directly related. And so that's, and I'm going to approach it from the sixth step on the Eightfold Path, which is wise effort, or right effort, or wholesome effort. I prefer wholesome these days is my favorite translation. It's also the fifth of the ten paramis, and it's something that the Buddha talks about a lot in a lot of different places, and it's something he emphasizes. But at the same time, as I said, it's like we have this idea that effort is somehow unpleasant. So there's like contradictions about effort that we have to sort of resolve in our minds almost before we can sort of decide to put some effort into things. So I want to talk a little bit about those contradictions as well. But I want to start by reading something from Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah was one of the principal teachers of Jack Kornfeld and other prominent teachers in this lineage. And this is from his book, Being Dharma, which is essentially a translation of some of his Dharma talks. It's a really wonderful book if you want to dig deep into the Dharma world. Practice really has to depend on steadfastness and patient endurance. Some people start to practice meditation and they have ideas and desires as to how they want it to be. They expect the mind to be calm right away. But the old seeds and habits of turmoil are there, so the practitioners will have no to experience their ripening. It's important to make efforts when this distress appears. We might feel that we should be fine without such disciplines that cause us to feel bothered and oppressed. We could eat and sleep in comfort and at will. We could talk about whatever we like when we have the urge. We could go here and there as we wish, and following our impulses like this would bring well-being. The teachings of the Buddha talk about resisting, grating against things. The way of transcendence grates against the worldly. Right view grates against wrong view. Purity grates against impurity. These things are always going to be incompatible. Pretty straightforward, right? It's like we think it should just be easy. You know, I'll just meditate. You know, you see these all these things in popular magazines these days where it says, you know, the 10-minute a day meditation plan to great happiness. And you go, it doesn't actually work that way. It takes effort. There's another sort of angle on this. And then often we're told, and in certain Buddhist traditions, we're told that we just have to relax. We have Buddha nature, and all we have to do is let that Buddha nature shine forth. It sounds like we don't have to actually do anything. We just have to let it shine forth. We just have to relax. Just be. And though in the terms of absolute reality, yes, this is true. We all have Buddha nature. And yes, it does shine forth all the time. But the fact is, in our day-to-day experience of life, that's not, for most of us anyway, what we experience. In fact, we experience often quite the opposite. The world seems to be full of suffering. And we seem to be anything but perfect. So, right effort, wholesome effort is the way to sort of get those two things into alignment. Wholesome effort is what allows our Buddha nature to shine forth. And in the process, brings joy to our lives. So there are four aspects to wholesome effort. And I want to read another little thing here. This is from Joseph Goldstein's book, Insight Meditation. It's sort of his early book on actually teaching how the practice worked. What then is the training of the heart, the transformation of consciousness? Consciousness is simply knowing. But along with each moment of knowing, different associated mental states may arise. The teachings have a lot to say about these states. Unwholesome ones like greed, hatred, fear, and delusion, and wholesome ones such as mindfulness, compassion, love, and wisdom. We can understand the training of the heart as being what the Buddha called the four great efforts. In our practice, we make the effort to diminish the unwholesome mental states that have already arisen and to prevent those that have not yet arisen from arising. And conversely, we make the effort to strengthen those wholesome mental states that are already developed and to cultivate and develop the wholesome states that have not yet arisen. So this is the usual thorough Buddhist way. Now, here's four different things. Do what you can to make sure that unwholesome mind states don't arise. Because unwholesome mind states make us unhappy. So if we can do what you can to make sure that unwholesome mind states do not arise. When unwholesome mind states do arise, do what you can to diminish them and release them, get rid of them, or at least mellow them out a little bit. And then conversely, do whatever you can to cultivate wholesome mind states. And if a wholesome mind state is present, do whatever you can to make it last longer, to make it have it hang out, let it be there more. So that over time, with right effort, we have less and less and less of the unwholesome mind states arising, and more and more and more of the wholesome mind states arising. There's a great book about a woman named Deepa Ma, who was a student, the teacher of Joseph Goldstein. And at one point, someone asked Deepa Ma, what was her day-to-day experience of mind? What was her mind like? She said, my mind is full of mindfulness and metta. And that's all. That was the only two mind states she ever experienced. Nothing but wholesome mind states. Apparently, it was when you hung out with her, it was pretty obvious. That's where she was. What it was like too? It was like, it's just an interesting idea that that's where we're headed. Man, most of us are sort of somewhere in the middle between that and the other extremes. But it's interesting to know that beings. And this is a woman who was a contemporary. I mean, she lived in the 20th century, and was some people. I know, I've met, have studied with her, and it's like, people, this is not something magical. This is something that happens. There are people who have developed their mind to such a state that they only experience wholesome mind states. I find this encouraging, that it's like, oh, this is actually possible, that this could actually be something that's worthwhile. Okay. So the first aspect is to do what we can to prevent unwholesome mind states from arising. The first, it's like, this seems so obvious, but it's something we don't do a lot of. For instance, you know, we know that if I do something, or I go someplace, or I spend time with somebody, or whatever, you know, some combination of things I do, I know where that goes. I know this is going to lead me into an unwholesome pattern of thought or even action. But we do it anyway, because it's habit. We have these habits, these habits of unwholesome practice, that we fall into them because they're habitual patterns. But at some point, it's like we know where this is going, but we go there anyway. It's like it's an interesting psychological thing, I think. If we actually have a correct understanding of the meaning of the five precepts, which are the ethical underpinnings of Buddhist practice, that's the way to prevent, to make it less likely we fall into these unwholesome mind states. That's the medicine, the antidote, if you like. You know, the five precepts, of course, I'm sure you're all familiar with, you know, non-harming, taking only what is offered, right speech, abstaining from sexual misconduct, and abstaining from abusing alcohol and drugs that cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. I'm not going to spend a long time talking about these. David talked about these wonderfully a while ago. But it's like, what I want to point out is that just by looking at life through those precepts, using those precepts as sort of the guidelines, which is what they're meant to be, we enjoy what the Buddha called the bliss of blamelessness. Sounds kind of nice, the bliss of blamelessness. If we really try and act from the five precepts as being the base of how we interact in the world, we get to have the joy of the bliss of blamelessness. Yeah. For instance, this is a little example. You know, it's a Mark Twain quote. I love Mark Twain quotes. Mark Twain said about right speech, he said, "The best thing about always telling the truth is you never have to remember what you said." The bliss of blamelessness, right? It's true. You think of it. You tell, you know, this happens a lot in families. You tell one person in the family, well, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then you go, oh, but don't tell so-and-so. And then you tell so-and-so a slightly different version of that, right? And then, unfortunately, those two people talk to each other and family chaos typically ensues. And it's just, if you just always tell the truth, you never have to remember what you said. It's also, people like it. People feel something when they're around someone who's like that, who's always truthful. It sets them at ease. It's a wonderful feeling. You feel like you can just trust this person. And it changes, it brings joy to other people's lives when we operate from that point of view, not only with truthfulness, but with all of the five precepts. The interesting thing is about the precepts is, and this is what I wanted to, the main point I wanted to make, is that the precepts aren't rules. It's not like, do this, don't do that. There's no wagging finger. They're practices. Just like meditation is a practice, or doing yoga is a practice, or playing the flute is a practice. The precepts are meant to be practices. Joseph, once again, this is from Joseph Goldstein from his book Mindfulness. So much of what the Buddha taught seems so obvious. Don't kill, don't steal, don't harm. Still, as we try to apply and practice this in our lives, we can come to the forward edge of our understanding and commitment. And this edge can be a challenging place to be. One teacher commented that if practicing the precepts doesn't make us uncomfortable, it's probably a sign we should investigate them more deeply. That's a great sentence, huh? If practicing the precepts doesn't make us uncomfortable, it's probably a sign we should investigate them more deeply. I appreciate this comment because it points to these steps on the path as actual practices, things to understand and investigate in our lives, rather than taking it for granted that we're basically good people and then looking no further. This takes effort. Here we are, back to effort, but from that effort comes joy. The second aspect of right effort is to do whatever we can to get rid of unwholesome states of mind once they have arisen. And we all know when they've arisen, right? When we're angry or we're fearful or we're being somewhat less than compassionate, shall we say, perhaps, or whatever, we all have our own favorite forms of unwholesome mind states, full of desire, lust, anger, greed, jealousy. We all experience these. We're all human beings. The first thing you have to know is that the general antidote for all of these, the general thing we have to put effort into, is to be mindful of them. Just to be actually aware that that's what's happening. To be mindful that we have fallen into an unwholesome mind state. No matter where, I've read lots of different commentaries on these things, and it's always the same answer. First step, be mindful. Know that that's what's actually happening. Yeah, right now, I'm angry. Because often, when we're caught in these mind states, there's some sort of associated story about it. You know, anger can have this sort of self-righteous story. Well, they shouldn't have done that, and they're wrong, and I'm right. And we get caught in this story, this story about ourselves and these other people, and we don't see, we're not mindful of what's underlying the story. So the first effort is to actually, when we get caught in these unwholesome mind states that cause suffering for ourselves and others, it's just to know that that's what's happening. To be actually consciously aware. And then, typically what's recommended is that we have to accept that, yeah, I'm capable. I'm capable of experiencing this. This is part of my mental makeup. I have the capability of being angry, full of anger or jealousy or lust or whatever. And that's okay. It may be really unpleasant. Pretty much guaranteed to be unpleasant. But it's okay. There's nothing wrong with us if we're caught in these mind states, other than we're human. That's the only thing that's wrong. We have a body and a mind, and we're human beings. So yeah, sometimes this is what happens. What often happens is either we pretend they're not there at all, we're not very mindful of them, or we then do what's called stick the second arrow in. Oh, I'm full of anger. I'm really bad. I must be a really bad person. Now I've got anger and shame. Yeah, I got the double whammy just like that. You know, what's called an MKA, a multiple Kalesa attack, is going on, right? And we just amplify and make it worse. We beat ourselves up for being. What's wrong with me? I'm such an angry person. No, you're a human being. And sometimes human beings, this is what they experience. The problem isn't that you experience these emotions, these unwholesome mind states. It's the problem that we then react out in the world from these places. That's what we're trying to work with. And that's why it's so important that we learn skillful means to get them to calm down, to go away, to stop. The first one is be mindful of it, accept it, look at it, pay attention to it, don't push it away, don't be averse to it, be okay with it. And we might, you know, go through that several times with the same, once we have the courage, because effort requires courage, just to look at these things, the courage to actually look at these things as opposed to just reject them. Once you have the courage to really investigate, where's this coming from, this unpleasant stuff in my mind and my body, because there's always a very strong physical discomfort as well. So looking at it. But after a certain point, you end up sort of feeling like you're wallowing it. Well, it's the fifth time today I've been caught in the same old story about whatever it was. Then it's time to investigate ways to actually let these mind states go. And there is a wonderful sutta that I'm going to read little bits of. I won't read you the whole thing because it's quite repetitive. But this is I won't even try and pronounce the Pali. It's the removal of the sutta for the removal of distracting thoughts. In other words, how do we get, this is the recommended way to apply effort to release unwholesome mind states. This is useful information, I think. And the teaching is quite specific, actually. First one is, these are steps. You try step one. If it doesn't work, go on to step two, sort of thing. So step one is give attention to something wholesome instead. So you're finding yourself ranting about something or someone, more likely someone, right? One of those stories where, you know that guy, he's just such a blah, 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 blah. We're going on and it's we're caught in some unwholesome mind state about this person or these people. Just shift that. So the classic antidote at this layer is to actually say you're angry at someone. Consciously, if you can, do metta for them instead. Replace the unwholesome mind state with the wholesome one. If it isn't someone involved, you're just sort of generally annoyed and grumpy, then do something that makes you smile. Consciously choose something wholesome instead. Shift the mind consciously. The analogy, and each of these has a classic analogy, and the analogy is to remove a coarse peg by replacing it with a fine one. In the old days when they built things, they didn't have nails. So they attach two pieces of wood, like one like this, to drive a wooden peg through here into here. And they'd start with coarse pegs, and then eventually they'd knock out the coarse peg and put in a fine one to get that finished look and make it last longer. But it was all of Buddha's analogies were things that people understood in their day-to-day lives. Then, if that doesn't work, and I'll read a little bit of the wording here. Oops, I'm on the wrong page. Sorry. But so he's talking about the next stage, where he says, if that doesn't work, here's the next thing to do. And the next thing to do would be to actually, if while he's giving attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should examine the danger in those thoughts thus. These thoughts are unwholesome. They are reprehensible. They result in suffering. When he examines the danger in those thoughts, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. And then here's the analogy. Just as a man or a woman, young, youthful, and fond of ornaments, would be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted if the carcass of a snake or a dog were hung around his or her neck. So you think about the actual unwholesomeness of what you're doing or thinking, or that where the mind's gone is unwholesome, and you actually see it, look at it. And, you know, the analogy is, I mean, it's a pretty gross analogy, but it's like, once again, this is would be something people in the Buddhist time would understand. You know, imagine what it would be like to have a dead snake or dog hung around your neck. That's what the Buddha is saying it's like to be. You think, oh, if I do this, this is where it's going. It's really going to be bad. It's going to be unpleasant. I can see it's going to be just like having a dead snake hung around my neck. So this might encourage you. And then it goes on in the same vein. If that doesn't work, step three. I mean, these are progressive. Try to forget the thoughts. So the analogy here is like, well, just close your eyes or look away. So this is the next layer of effort. Actually consciously go, no, I don't see that, I don't hear that, I don't know that. Consciously look away. Then if that doesn't work, try stilling the thought formations. This is a really interesting analogy. So actually trying, you know, because the mind is spinning with all these thoughts. Then try and still the mind, slow the mind down. So, just as the man walking fast might consider, why am I walking fast? What if I walk slowly? And he would walk slowly. Then he might consider, why am I walking slowly? What if I stand? And he would stand. And then he might consider, why am I standing? What if I sit? And he would sit. Then he might consider, why am I sitting? What if I lie down? And he would lie down. So it's like less and less and less energy. In practical terms, in our practice, if you're sitting, for instance, you might actually try and shift from that whirling mind to some form of very precise concentration exercise. My favorite one is counting the breaths backwards from 10. Like, you know, in, out, 10. And then in, out, 90, and you count all the way down to 1, and then you go back and start all over again. It's pretty hard to be full of unwholesome thoughts when what you're doing is counting your breath backwards from 10, because if you go back to those unwholesome thoughts, you're going to lose track, just like that. The rule being, if you lose track, you have to start all over again. Just to make you sort of honest. But it's a really simple technique to sort of shift the mind by making it very, very concentrated on something very simple. I mean, and this is just one way. I mean, that's why, you know, in sort of the vernacular world, you know, people who you're lying in bed at night trying to fall asleep and your mind's whirling, count sheep. That's what we're talking about here. I'm full of all these thoughts. I want my mind to go still. You count, you know, you visualize one, to, you know, the sheep jumping, you know, the classic cartoon of the sheep jumping over the fence. But that's what they're talking about here. Then we come to the final one of these. If while he is giving attention to stilling the thought formations of these thoughts, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion. Then, with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he should beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. Just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him, and crush him. This is, sometimes, this is what we got to do. Nope, I'm not going to let that happen anymore. Like, you have to be really sort of stern and firm, and I'm not going to go there. Nope. That's the final antidote. The final. But notice this is number five. Often people start here, right? You don't want to start here. This is like, nothing else has worked. I've tried all these other things. I've tried just to replace it with a wholesome thought. I've tried, you know, to think of the results if I follow through with these thoughts. I've tried slowing things down. I've tried just really concentrating the mind. None of those worked. Okay, now I got to be really firm. No, I'm not going to go there. And understand, that might not work either. All these are just progressively more interesting antidotes. But there's no guarantee that any of them will work. But it's like all of these, as you can see, require effort. This is like right effort. And the result is often, in my experience from practice, is that they do work. If we find the right one. And the skillful means, the practice, learning to practice in this way, to be skillful in your practice, is a really useful tool. You know, people have this idea that insight meditation, I'm just going to sit there, and whatever happens, I just note it, and that's what it's going to be. And it's not. The insight meditation is this balance between that form, that sort of open, taking in what's going on and noting it, and at certain points, using skillful means to steer the mind a little bit and go, no, I don't. I know where this road goes. I don't need to go there. I'll go over here instead. And it's when to choose to do that and not do it out of avoidance, not do it out of aversion. That's the delicate balance that we're always trying to achieve. It's like, it's easy to go, no, I should never be angry, right? I should never be angry. So if I ever experience anger, I'm bad, so I should never experience anger. So every time anger rises, we do something to push it away and pretend it's not there. That's not wholesome either. That's just replacing one unwholesome mind state with another one. You know, let's have lots of this kind of aversion instead of that kind of aversion. It's not skillful. The third aspect of right effort is sort of a partner to the first. Do whatever you can to cultivate wholesome mind states. Seems obvious, like, yeah, we should do what we can to be wholesome. This is the whole idea behind the Brahmavihara practices. The metta practice is the one that's predominantly emphasized within the Theravadan community that I'm part of. But also, you know, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. All of these are really wholesome mind states. The Buddha emphasized these, but this particular four, sometimes called the four jewels, as mind states that we actually want to cultivate. The key word there is cultivate. Yeah. We can't just assume that I'm always going to be full of loving kindness and compassion and sympathetic joy and equanimity. We have to do something about it. We have to cultivate. Cultivation, you know, this garden, everybody's planting gardens this time of year, right? Like, you know, working in the garden a lot. Well, you know what it's like. You got to, you know, turn the soil and got to plant the seeds and you got to water and you got to pull out the weeds and all that. Lots of effort involved in cultivation. And then you get all these beautiful flowers. I had a salad tonight with a bunch of different things from my garden. It was so nice. It's like, then you get the joy. Then you get the happiness because you put in the effort. You cultivated something. This is this is from the Dalai Lama. This is from a book called The Book of Joy, which everywhere I go now, Dharma teachers are quoting from this book. It's like, it's just, if you haven't encountered it yet, it is one of the most wonderful books I've read in a long time. Just, you read it, and you, just reading it makes me happy. But he has so many wonderful things. And he's talking about, in this case, compassion. And that generally when you think about compassion, you think it's, which takes effort. You think compassion is like, oh, you're dealing with people and with situations that are quite unpleasant often. Where does joy come from with compassion? How do we get happiness from being compassionate? This is what the Dalai Lama has to say. This concern for others is something very precious. We humans have a special brain, but this brain causes a lot of suffering because it is always thinking me, 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 me. The more time you spend thinking about yourself, the more suffering you will experience. The incredible thing is that when we think of alleviating other people's suffering, our own suffering is reduced. This is the true secret of happiness. This is a very practical thing. In fact, it is common sense. Dalai Lama is so simple and practical, you know. But it's like, this is what he's saying is, by being compassionate, by being concerned about others, we find more joy in our own life. Just by putting that effort, by actually consciously not only thinking about it, but in this case he's actually saying we actually do something to alleviate the suffering of others. It's an active thing. This is where people get joy from volunteering. I'm a big advocate of volunteering in the community. It's so... I've got such joy from doing the volunteer work. I've done various different things in my life. And it's always been such a joyful time. And you're often around people in situations that are not that pleasant. But it's just that sense of giving and that sense of not being sort of caught up in my own junk and my old story just makes you feel happy. Just doing something useful in the world. Helps others. The fourth and final aspect of right effort is often the most difficult. When wholesome mind states have arisen in the mind, do whatever you can to preserve them. You'd think this would be easy, but actually it takes quite a bit of effort because our whole mindset is usually, if we're not being very mindful, uh-oh, something's going to go wrong. Uh-oh, I better watch out for this. Oh no, Donald Trump's doing this today, and now what's going to happen? You know, that's the common version of it right now. And we totally miss the wholesome mind states that arise on all the time. We just don't see them because we're so busy looking for what's wrong, what's bad, what the big problems are. We just don't see what's actually happening. And I wanted to sort of talk about this by
singing a well-known Dharma song. It's something I don't often do, sing. I think it'll be good. And this is a Dharma song I'm sure you all know. And so what I'm going to encourage you to do is sing along with me. And you'll see how this works, okay? And it's very simple. And just, I'll start singing. And if you know the song, just join in. Okay? Everybody's ready? Got your singing. Don't worry. If I can sing, anybody can sing. If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. If you're happy and you know it, and you're not afraid to show it. If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. This is a great Dharma song. No, I'm actually quite serious here. First off, if you're happy and you know it, you have to actually see that you're in a wholesome mind state. If you're happy and you know it. That's the first, it's just like everything else. Mindfulness is always the beginning of these things. If we're actually mindful of the happiness. Okay, so if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. Then do something. Share it with everyone else. Let other people know that you're happy. And if clapping your hands doesn't work, you can, I think, stomp your feet or shout hooray or the other verses, right? So now we actually have to actually express that happiness and let it out into the world. Which takes a lot of effort sometimes, because it's like we want to sort of like, people will think I'm weird if I walk around smiling all the time. You know, it's like it'd be somehow not. And it's like, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. If you're happy and you know it, and you're not afraid to show it. That's that third thing I was talking about. We have to not be afraid to experience happiness, to experience joy, to experience compassion, to experience equanimity, to experience calm. How often are we find ourselves in this really calm, still space, and we go, oh, something must be wrong. Something's going to happen. You know, as opposed to just going, oh, this is kind of nice, just hanging out here in this calm, still space. Too often, you know, when these wholesome mind states arise, the other thing that might arise is, I don't deserve this. I'm not good enough. I can't allow myself to be this happy, or this calm, or this whatever wholesome mind state has arisen. You know, because our culture tells us we don't deserve these things. It's deeply embedded in our culture, in the teachings of our culture, is that it's not okay to just walk around calm and smiling. What's wrong with you? You know, you're not on edge getting ready for the next great disaster that's going to happen, whatever that is. But we have to actually be happy, know it, share it with others, and be okay with it. And then, through that effort, this one's here, we are back, that this takes effort, then it spreads around. There's no magic to any of this. It's just being, and all of these different forms of wholesome effort, it's always be mindful, pay attention, and then shift things to something more wholesome by either avoiding unwholesome mind states, trying to shift unwholesome mind states once they've arisen, cultivating, creating the causes and conditions, in Buddhist terms, that wholesome mind states might arise. And then if a wholesome mind state has arisen, be aware of it, and then do what you can to maintain it. Feed it. Feed the wholesome. I want to just finish with this. It's a poem by Mary Oliver called The Song of the Builders. On a summer morning, I sat down on a hillside to think about God, a worthy pastime. Near me, I saw a single cricket. It was moving the grains of the hillside this way and that way. How great was its energy, how humble its effort. Let us hope it will always be like this. Each of us going on in our inexplicable ways, building the universe. So we have a few minutes for questions, comments, thoughts, sharings, whatever arises in your mind. And don't feel at all, yeah, at the back there. Yes.
On the other hand, I find that sometimes I actually make the choice to go into areas where there is fertile ground for challenges. And because otherwise I sort of get my comfort zone. And so it's just kind of a slippery slope where you can say, oh, I'm not going to go there because that's going to cause this. And that could become a habit right there.
Yeah, that's that skillful means I was talking about. You have to, I mean, you could turn into this timid person who never does anything because, oh, who knows what's going to happen now. Yes. There's that balance between those things. But I'm thinking more like, I'll give you a personal example. In my somewhat misspent youth, I went through a period, mostly in college, where I would get like, falling down drunk. I mean, literally falling down drunk. And I remember this really, it was my last summer before my last year of college. I was out in a bar with a bunch of guys and we were doing what we were normally going to do. And I could see where this was going. And for some reason, this sort of light went on in my head. Like, you don't want to do this. And I literally just got up and walked out of the bar and walked home. It's like we were there. And I knew they were going to drive home drunk anyway. So I'm just gone, and I walked home. And I never drank to excess after that. So I still like a beer now and then with a meal. I still may have had one too many, like two beers instead of one a couple of times. But since that time, it's like, no, I know where this goes. I'm going to end up on the bathroom floor, passed out. If I stay here, why do this? Because I know it's unpleasant afterwards. And most of the time, in the midst of it, sometimes it was pretty unpleasant too. It was because it got stupid. So that's sort of a personal, what I mean by that was, it was quite clear. Sometimes, yeah, we have to do things that push our edges. But even then, as long as we're being very mindful as we do that, we probably won't get into the unwholesome mind states anyway. The mindfulness being the key to that, probably. Make sense? Yeah, we have to, there's always this balance between timidity and being pure. I'm so pure, I never do anything wrong. That's not a wholesome place to be either. That's spiritual pride might go there, cause the rise there. Okay, other thoughts, questions, comments? Let's just dedicate the merit. The idea behind this is simply that hopefully we've all gained something by being here together, sharing the Dhamma. Whatever we gain, we just give it away, send it out into the universe, where it's so clearly needed. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you for your kind attention.